I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Every so often, we like to hear from those who've been there before us, those with experience and knowledge, people who aren't just smart, but wise. Today, a special edition of Wisdom Watch. We talk with Bernard Shaw, who was a top anchor at CNN for more than 20 years until he retired in 2001. He describes himself as straight-laced and old-fashioned, the kind of journalist who sticks to the facts. He reported on the Jonestown massacre and on the pro-democracy demonstrations in Tiananmen Square. He interviewed Saddam Hussein and reported from Iraq during the first Gulf War, giving minute-by-minute accounts of the bombing. He moderated presidential as well as vice presidential debates, and this week he is being honored by the National Association of Black Journalists, which is meeting here in Las Vegas. He's receiving the group's Lifetime Achievement Award, and he joins us now in the studio. Bernard Shaw, it is a pleasure to speak with you.
I share your delight. Thank you.
What made you want to be a journalist?
When I was growing up in Chicago on the South Side, I started watching television. In 1952, I know that because that's when we got our first Zenith 12-inch round TV set, black and white, and I used to watch CBS News, and my idol was Edward R. Murrow, and I said to myself, I want to be like that man. That combined with my father's habit of reading four newspapers a day, coupled with the weekly Chicago Defender, the black newspaper, and the Pittsburgh Courier, so we had a lot of ink flowing through our apartment. I learned to read when I was 3 1/2 years old, and I've had the habit. And I used to deliver those papers as a paper
goodness.
Boy. So that basically is where it started.
You have got to tell the Walter Cronkite story.
Well, along with growing up, Cronkite also was an idol of mine. And I went into the Marine Corps, and I was based in Hawaii for 2 years on Oahu. And one morning, I was reading the local newspaper there in the morning, and I saw this picture of Walter and his wife, Betsy. And the caption was, Walter Cronkite is in the island shooting scenes for 20th Century. He's staying at the Reef Hotel in Waikiki. Well, that was all I needed. So I called the hotel 34 times.
You remember that you called 34 times?
Yes, 34 times and left 34 messages over 2 days. And got no response. And then one day I came back from work, and there was this message. Walter Cronkite called. Please call him. And I called him right away, and we set up the time. He said, I can see you for 15 minutes in the lobby at the hotel when I come back from another island. So I put on my nicely pressed Marine Corps tropical uniform and went down there and waited. 1 hour passed, 2 hours passed, and then I hear this voice, gee, Sergeant, I hope I haven't been keeping you waiting. Well, he had promoted me from corporal to sergeant on the spot. I turned around, and there he was with his wife. He said, well, come on upstairs. And Betsy looked at him as if to say, don't even try it. So they had to go to a formal that night, so she wanted to go upstairs, and we sat in the lobby. 15 minutes lasted, and then it was 20 minutes, then it was 40 minutes, and I said, Mr. Cronkite, I've taken up enough of your time. This has been my banquet. You're going to one tonight. Thank you very much. And it was a very uplifting and a very inspiring conversation.
As I'm thinking about it now, I don't think there were any African-American correspondents at the major nets at
no,
that time.
No, absolutely none.
What do you think gave you the idea that you could do it despite that? Not that you could do the work, but that you'd get in the door.
There was nothing that made me think that I could not or would not. My attitude was, this is what I want to do. I can make a contribution to this craft. And I wasn't thinking color.
You talked about, though, I remember reading a piece by you or describing you or from you somehow in Missing Pages. It's a collection of memoirs of black journalists by the late Wallace Terry. And, you know, it's a wonderful thing. And I learned some things about you. I've known you for years. And I learned a lot of things about you. One, that you covered the late Martin Luther King Jr.
Yes, mm-hmm. His open housing campaign. In fact, that was my first salary job. I worked at a radio station, WYNR. And after I went on board, I was just pulling wire copy in the newsroom and helping getting newscasts set up. And Dr. King came to town. They said, we are going to assign you to cover this man. They paid me $50 a week. And I lived and breathed that story, so much so that King and I became very close. He used to call me Doctor, that Southern honorific. And I would cover him night and day. And I got to know him very well. And the one memorable thing he said to me was, one day you're going to make it, just do some good. Hmm. Just do some good.
You know, you've always been a cool cucumber, Bernie. And I wonder if your cool was ever tested. I'm thinking, gosh, starting so early in your career, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, that must have been awful.
It was the worst day on this earth for me. I was on the air, I was anchoring, and I had just closed out and I was doing a weather segment. And the door opened, and one of the staff members, Bill Berg, walked in. His hand was trembling, and he put this yellow piece of wire copy. And it was a UPI flash, not a bulletin, a flash. Dr. Martin Luther King has been shot in Memphis. And I went from weather to reading that historic bulletin, and within 2 minutes, the door opens again, another hand lays a piece of paper, flash, Dr. King is dead. And I got shivers like I'm getting now, and my voice started trembling, and I got this rocket of a phone call, get to Memphis right away. I had no clothes, I couldn't go home. I went from downtown North Michigan Avenue right out to O'Hare Field. And I and other people in the media had the same idea. We got on this plane, and this Delta flight was so crowded, reporters were sitting in the aisles.
That's amazing.
And when I arrived, I had to pay a cab driver $100 to take me into City Hall. That was the first police station headquarters, City Hall. I went upstairs, and I started walking down this long corridor. It was late at night. It was around midnight then. And every 10 feet, there was a fluorescent lighting fixture on. So you went from light to shadow as you went down. And I walked past this door, and I heard muffled voices. And I looked in, and there, standing in the room, trembling, hugging one another, was Reverend Ralph Abernathy, Andrew Young, and Jesse Jackson. They were in a huddle, trembling, crying. And I looked at them. My instinct was to step into the room, and I just stepped back.
Why?
Out of respect for their grieving moment.
Well, it's interesting, Bernie, because, you know, I've known you for years. I've never heard you talk about those times. And, you know, some people who covered the civil rights movement, you know, talk about it all the time. And is it you just don't?
I try to be as dispassionate as possible so I can have a clearer head to do my job. The one time I lost it and was just viscerally angry was in Memphis. Mrs. Coretta Scott King designated two reporters to fly on the plane, Bobby Kennedy's campaign plane, to Memphis to get Dr. King's body and fly him home to Atlanta. And Mrs. King said, Shaw from Westinghouse and Johnson from the New York Times. By this time, rioting had broke out across the country, and my news director in Chicago told headquarters in New York, we need him back right away. And they said, Shaw, do not get on the plane to Atlanta. We want you back in Chicago as soon as possible. Well, I had to cover the departure before I left for Chicago under orders. And I stood on the tarmac next to this white hearse. And inside was this bronze coffin, and inside the coffin, Dr. King's body. And I just started crying uncontrollably because they put this coffin on this conveyor belt. The coffin went up into the belly of the plane. It taxied away and took off. I walked into the terminal and got on the plane and went to Chicago.
You must have been furious.
I was so angry. I was crying and I was trembling. I was just so angry. And I regret it, completely losing it emotionally.
Why?
Because I'm supposed to be a composed storyteller. And my vision, my perceptions, my abilities are clouded when I become throttled by emotion.
I remember another time, you were a foreign correspondent in Nicaragua, and that you had just left because you were filing from you'd gone to another filing point.
Oh, yes.
And your colleague,
Bill Stewart,
had gone in to replace you.
That was during the time
and was
of
murdered.
The Panama Canal treaty debate in the U.S. Senate. I had to go into Panama to do this exclusive interview. And the night before, the Sandinista guerrillas were inch by inch getting closer to the capital, Managua. I said, you folks know that I'm leaving tomorrow morning. The New York Times, the Post are here in town. And they said, okay, go to Panama tomorrow. We'll send somebody down. 2 days later, Bill Stewart stepped off the plane to cover for me. And Bill Stewart was a veteran correspondent, and he had been filming in the city. And he walked past this checkpoint, and this soldier ordered him to the ground. And he kept saying, you're showing periodista, I'm a journalist. Mm-hmm. He showed his press credentials. He lay prone on the ground. The soldier walked up, lowered his M16 rifle, and fired one round in the back of the head. What he did not know was that our cameraman, Jack Clark, was in a Volkswagen van about 50 yards away. And all of this is on tape. And then ABC News announced to the world that we had evidence. And we put that on the satellite for any TV station anywhere in the States or around the world that wanted it, free of charge. And that truly was the beginning of the end of Anastasio Somoza's regime.
Did you feel guilty that Stewart had come
to
replace
day,
you?
To this day, I still wish that I hadn't gone down to Panama. If I hadn't gone to Panama, Bill would still be alive today. Can't bring him back, but I wish that I hadn't gone to Panama.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Bernard Shaw, principal anchor for CNN for more than 20 years. Bernie, I think it's funny, a lot of people probably don't know that you speak Spanish, or you're a foreign correspondent, Latin American bureau chief, but they do remember your work covering politics, and I think they especially remember this question that you asked during the 1988 presidential debate.
Governor, if Kitty Dukakis were raped and murdered, would you favor an irrevocable death penalty for the killer?
No, I don't, Bernard, and I think you know that I've opposed the death penalty during all of my life. I don't see any evidence that it's a deterrent, and I think there are better and more effective ways to deal with violent crime. We've done so in my own state, and it's one of the reasons why we have had the biggest drop in crime of any industrial state in America, why we have the lowest murder rate of any industrial state in America.
Bernie, it was one of the first questions you asked in the debate, and I think a lot of people see it as one of the reasons that Dukakis lost the election. I mean, he was sitting on a lead. He had his opponent, George Bush, Bush 41, had substantial negatives. The history was against him. He was a sitting vice president. People think, oh, you know, he shouldn't have won. And there's something about that question that just was one of the things that turned the tide. I'm just wondering, first of all, do you buy that that's one of the reasons Dukakis lost? And second, what made you ask that?
I asked that question because it was relevant to one of the prime issues in that campaign, capital punishment. The Republicans routinely tried to paint Governor Dukakis as being soft on crime. They tried to portray him as being a cold-hearted technocrat. So I wanted to ask a question that I hope would pierce the politician's armor. So I asked the governor that question. As to his response to my question costing him the election, I leave that to other interpreters.
Do you think, you know, you said earlier in our conversation that you are a journalist first. You said this to, do you think?
Oh, yes. I caught a lot of hell from some black journalists.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about that.
Yeah. What I said was, I am a journalist who happens to be black. And some people did not like that. I am a black man. I am an African American. I love it. I'm very comfortable in my skin. I have allegiance to my people and their survival and their success. I have allegiance to my, pardon me for pounding on the table, I have allegiance to the profession of journalism. They're not contradictions.
When you look back on your career, what's the one achievement you're most proud of?
And that's a difficult question to answer. It's none of the stories. Say for one, it's none of the stories I covered over four decades. Being an inspiration to anyone in the world who wants to become a journalist. because I had my examples, Edward R. Murrow, Walter Cronkite. The most important story I ever covered was the 1985 summit in Geneva between Mikhail Gorbachev and President Ronald Wilson Reagan, because these two powerful leaders sitting on arsenals that are almost incomprehensible in their megatonnage sat down and agreed to start down the path of reducing nuclear arms. And I think that was the most important story I ever covered.
You know, your former network, CNN, from which you retired, where you served for 20 years as a principal anchor, retired in 2001 to a lot of people's great regret. But now some of the more popular programs at your network are Lou Dobbs, which is very opinion-oriented, to the point where some people wonder whether that's really sort of taking over the business. And I just wonder what you think about that.
Well, here I go walking the plank of controversy. The tack that my favorite network has taken raises my blood pressure. I don't like it. Lou and I, we're both fellow Marines and we're friends. I don't like it at all. As a journalist, you, the listener, you, the reader, or the viewer, need not be concerned about Bernard Shaw's personal opinions. My personal opinions ought not mean a damn if I'm doing my job correctly. Consumers of news are not being served well or properly. It's one of the reasons why I'm so glad to be gone. I don't miss it.
You don't?
None whatsoever. I just came from a golf course to your studio to do this interview. And I love being with my wifely friend of 33 years, Linda. I love being with our daughter, Anil, our son, Amar.
Well, that's good then. No regrets?
None whatsoever. Just that I can't live a second life.
Mr. Shaw, it's been a pleasure.
Mine too. Thank you very, very much.
Bernard Shaw was a principal anchor for CNN for more than 20 years. He joined us here in the studio, and he will be receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Association of Black Journalists this weekend. That's our program for today. We're in Las Vegas at the National Association of Black Journalists Convention. We're broadcasting from member station KNPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow. We'll be here in Las Vegas.